So, imagine you're holding a bucket of water.
Okay, a heavy bucket.
Right, exactly. You worked incredibly hard to fill this bucket, carrying it up a steep hill, but there's a microscopic hole right in the bottom.
Oh, man.
Yeah, and you can't see the water leaking out. It makes absolutely no sound, but month after month, the water level is just dropping.
Just slowly draining away.
Exactly. And that microscopic hole is exactly what is happening to your cash right now if you don't understand the hidden underlying mechanics of modern money.
Which is, frankly, most people.
Right. So today we're extracting the ultimate cheat sheet from this massive, definitive financial textbook. It's called Money Smarts, Volume 1 by Dan Kost.
And I mean, Kost is an absolute heavyweight in this space.
Yeah, he really is.
He published his first major analytical book on credit repair way back in 1982. Plus, he helped fundamentally architect the Consumer Credit Services Act.
Which completely reshaped consumer protections nationwide, right?
Right, exactly. And today he's the CEO of DocDen Worldwide.
Yeah.
So when he breaks down the architecture of corporate finance, securities, and bankruptcy, he's speaking from decades of practical warfare in the markets.
It's not just theory for him. So our mission today is to decode the mechanics of personal finance. We are pulling out the absolute most vital aha moments from this text.
The real game changers.
Yeah, from the underlying plumbing of everyday banking to the wild, uncharted frontiers of AI and decentralized digital assets.
It's a lot of ground to cover.
It is. But the goal of this deep dive is to basically serve as your ultimate shortcut to being financially well-informed, so you can navigate your capital without drowning in just this tidal wave of information overload.
Because, I mean, before we can talk about generating yield or optimizing a portfolio, we have to look at the structural reality of what money actually is today.
Right, you have to know what you're dealing with.
Exactly. The mechanics of the currency itself kind of dictate your entire defensive strategy.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because fiat currency isn't just, cash, it's essentially a psychological construct.
It really is. I mean, since the U.S. moved completely off the gold standard in 1971, the dollar isn't backed by physical bullion anymore.
It's not tied to a shiny piece of metal in a vault.
Right. Now, institutional investors, they do still use physical gold as a tangible hedge against systemic risk and monetary expansion. But the cash sitting in your checking account,
Yeah.
its valuation is driven entirely by monetary policy, supply, demand, and, well, it's just a baseline trust in the sovereign government that issues it.
It's basically a collective gentleman's agreement on a global scale. Like, the dollar has purchasing power strictly because everyone universally agrees it does.
Yeah, pretty much.
But that agreement comes with a huge structural catch.
What's fascinating here is how that fiat system mathematically forces your hand as an investor.
Because you can't just sit on it.
Exactly. Because fiat supply continually expands, purchasing power inevitably contracts. I mean, we all know how debasement works, right?
Inflation, basically.
Right, but Kost really emphasizes the stealth tax of it. Like, if your capital is just sitting in a standard account, yielding maybe 1%, but the real rate of currency debasement is 4 or 5%,
You're losing money.
you are experiencing a negative real yield. That's the microscopic hole in the bucket you were talking about.
Oh, wow.
You aren't just breaking even. The system literally guarantees that you are bleeding purchasing power every single day.
Which means the basic plumbing of where you hold your liquidity suddenly matters a lot. Cost goes really deep into the structural differences between banking institutions here.
It's so crucial.
It's not just a matter of who has the slicker mobile app, right? The fundamental incentive models are completely different.
Precisely. Because commercial banks, they're structurally designed to extract margin for their shareholders. They optimize for profit maximization.
They want to make money off of you.
Yes. Credit unions, on the other hand, are structurally nonprofits, and they're owned by the depositors themselves.
That's a huge distinction.
It is. That differing incentive model usually translates into tighter spreads, which basically means you generally see higher yields on your deposits and lower rates on lending facilities.
But regardless of the institution, you're still basically navigating the same core tools. You've got checking accounts for immediate, frictionless liquidity.
Right, your everyday spending money.
Yeah. Then money market accounts to chase a bit more yield without completely sacrificing access to your funds.
A good middle ground.
Exactly. And then certificates of deposit or CDs, where you are actively trading duration for yield.
Right, you lock the capital up for a fixed term, you get a premium rate. But if you break the lock early, the penalty basically negates the yield.
Yet, the most aggressive mechanism of wealth extraction mentioned in this section isn't the spread on a savings account.
No, not at all.
It's the overdraft fee.
Oh, yeah. It is such an asymmetric penalty. Like, if a transaction overdraws your account by, say, $5 for a cup of coffee.
The institution covers it? Sure.
They cover it, but then they hit you with a flat fee that, if you were to annualize it as an interest rate, would be astronomically high.
It's absurd when you do the math.
It really is. It's a massive drag on capital accumulation,
Yeah.
especially for people just starting out.
But the defense against this doesn't require like complex derivatives or
Well,
anything.
it's actually super simple.
Koss points out that the simplest, most brutal defense is literally just setting up automated digital alerts.
Yep.
Just tying your transaction ledger to real-time SMS alerts shifts you from being a passive participant to an active manager.
It completely neutralizes the overdraft trap.
And it instantly flags unauthorized drawdowns, putting a hard stop to that leak in your bucket.
But, because idle cash is structurally designed to lose purchasing power, you are eventually forced to deploy it.
You can't just hoard it under a mattress.
Right. You have to spend, you have to borrow, and you have to build a financial reputation.
Which brings us to the mechanics of credit.
Yeah, let's get into credit, because your credit file is essentially a continuous audit of your counterparty risk.
That's a great way to put it.
It's evaluating the statistical probability of you defaulting on an obligation. Lenders use it to price risk, landlords use it to assess lease reliability.
Even corporate employers use it during background checks now.
Exactly. So if that audit comes back looking toxic, your cost of capital skyrockets.
Yeah.
Suddenly, you're just priced out of competitive rates everywhere.
And cost dives really deep into credit repair here. Because when a file is damaged, the landscape is unfortunately flooded with unethical credit repair agencies that just sell a fantasy.
Scams, basically.
Total scams. They claim they can legally erase legitimate negative marks, usually by spamming the credit bureaus with frivolous automated disputes.
Just clogging up the system.
Right. Or even worse, they attempt to create synthetic credit identities, which is just outright fraud.
Don't do that. So the mechanical way to actually rebuild a damaged file is through secured credit facilities.
Yes, secured cards are amazing tools.
You basically post a cash collateral, say $1,000. That deposit fundamentally becomes your credit line.
So the lender has zero risk.
Exactly, because the loan is fully backed by your own capital. But as you cycle that utilization and make on-time payments, that positive behavioral data is fed directly into the reporting agencies.
Which mathematically overrides the historical defaults over time.
I want to throw a hypothetical at you, though.
Okay, sure.
Let's say a borrower totally loses their footing on this financial tightrope. Like a catastrophic medical event hits, or a localized economic downturn just wipes out their industry, and they are completely drowning in unserviceable debt.
The math just doesn't work anymore.
Right. Is it actually strategically better to just walk away, default, ignore the collections, and go off the grid? Or should they engage the formal legal machinery of bankruptcy?
That is such a vital strategic crossroad in the text. And honestly, defaulting is chaotic and legally hostile.
It's messy.
Very. If you simply stop servicing the debt, creditors initiate an aggressive legal process. They secure judgments.
And then what?
They will enforce wage garnishments, meaning a court actually orders your employer to divert a percentage of your gross income directly to the creditor before the money ever even hits your account.
Oh man, they just bypass you entirely.
Yes, they could freeze and sweep your deposit accounts. You lose absolute control of your cash flow.
You're basically bleeding out while trying to outrun the hounds.
Exactly. Bankruptcy, conversely, is a highly structured federal legal reset.
It's an official process.
Right. The moment a petition is filed, it triggers what is called an automatic stay.
Which does what exactly?
This is a federal injunction that instantly halts all collection activities.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, no calls, no garnishments, no lawsuits. The entire collection machinery just freezes. But the resolution paths split primarily into two distinct structures, Chapter 7 and Chapter 13.
Okay, break down the mechanics of those two for me.
So, Chapter 7 is a liquidation. A court-appointed trustee essentially takes control of your balance sheet.
Yeah, they look at everything you own.
Right. They identify any non-exempt assets, which could be a second property, unshielded equity in a vehicle, maybe luxury items. They liquidate them and distribute that capital to your creditors.
And after that.
Once that process is complete, the remaining eligible unsecured debt is fully discharged. It literally ceases to exist legally.
Okay, so that's chapter 7 and chapter 13.
Chapter 13 is a reorganization. You actually retain your assets, but your cash flow is fundamentally restructured.
How so?
You have to propose a binding 3 to 5 year repayment matrix to the court. You're effectively forced to live on a strict, court-approved budget, pushing all remaining disposable income into servicing a portion of the debt.
Wow. So Chapter 13 is literally like being placed into financial receivership. Like, you hit a pause button, but you are no longer the autonomous CEO of your own paycheck.
Exactly. The court steps in as the board of directors,
rationing out your income to creditors, whereas Chapter 7 is just throwing the whole messy closet away, liquidating the entire company and walking away from the shell.
That's a good way to look at it.
But cost highlights a massive trapdoor here, right? Because certain debts are legally superglued to your balance sheet. They survive liquidation.
Yes, the non-dischargeable liabilities.
Yes. You cannot discharge student loan debt without passing an incredibly rigorous, statistically improbable undue hardship test.
Almost impossible to pass.
And most tax liabilities are completely immune. Plus, domestic support obligations like child support or alimony, those completely bypass the bankruptcy shield.
They follow you regardless of the filing.
Which illustrates exactly why retaining tail risk is so dangerous, and why risk transfer is absolutely mandatory.
It really is the ultimate safety net.
If one catastrophic medical billing event or a liability lawsuit can force a complete liquidation of your balance sheet, you aren't actually building wealth.
No, you're just getting lucky day by day.
Exactly. Hence the mechanics of insurance. It's not just a monthly operational expense. It is the deliberate offloading of catastrophic risk to a counterparty pool.
Right. Health, auto, homeowners, life, liability.
You are paying a calculated premium to ensure that when a black swan event hits, the insurance pool absorbs the kinetic energy of that financial hit, not your personal balance sheet.
And, you know, once you cap your downside, once that risk is transferred and your credit file is optimized, your strategy shifts from defense to offense.
Time to actually grow the wealth.
Yes. You transition from just surviving the fiat debasement to leveraging the cost of capital to build wealth.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because the spread on borrowing costs can either build empires or completely destroy them.
Absolutely. The textbook breaks down the extreme divergence in the cost of money, which is represented as the annual percentage rate, or APR.
Okay, let's look at both sides.
On one end, you have secured facilities, like a mortgage. Because the debt is collateralized by real property, the risk premium for the lender is remarkably low.
So you get a low APR.
Exactly. Awesome. Furthermore, the amortization schedule forces you to build equity in an asset that historically outpaces baseline inflation.
But on the unsecured side, the math gets predatory incredibly fast, especially with payday loans.
Oh, it was brutal.
Cost outlines the compounding architecture of these short-term liquidity facilities. It's not just a high fee. A typical two-week advance might map out to a 400% annualized rate.
It is a mathematically designed debt trap. Like, if a borrower can't clear the principal within that strict 14-day window, the rollover fees capitalize.
Meaning you start paying interest on the fees.
Yes. The liability curve just goes parabolic, and the borrower is instantly crushed. It is literally the cost of money weaponized against the consumer.
So how do we flip the board then? If we know how the cost of money destroys capital, how do we pivot and engineer the system to push capital toward us?
Through what the text defines as positive collections.
Positive collections?
Yeah. In portfolio theory, a positive collection isn't just a random assortment of equities. It's a strategically grouped basket of assets engineered to deliver a positive expected return over time.
Which offsets that fiat debasement we talked about earlier.
Exactly. And the focus here is heavily on blue chip equities.
I'm going to push back on that a bit, though.
Okay, let's hear it.
The conventional wisdom is that blue chips, you know, the Coca-Colas, the IBMs, the Johnson & Johnsons, they are inherently stable because they are just massive.
Right.
But in an era where tech disruption can hollow out a legacy company's moat in like 3 years, is relying purely on historical stability actually safe?
That is a very fair point, and it raises an important question. But the textbook's mechanical answer is diversification of revenue, not just historical market cap.
What do you mean by that?
Well, true blue chips maintain pricing power and have deeply entrenched global supply chains that are just incredibly hard to replicate.
They have real physical infrastructure.
Right. They aren't totally immune to disruption, obviously, but their sheer cash reserves allow them to either acquire the disruptors or pivot their infrastructure.
Ah, I see.
And crucially, they deploy a portion of their free cash flow back to the shareholders as dividends.
Right. So you are unlocking two separate growth factors. You have the capital appreciation of the underlying equity as the company grows, plus a quarterly dividend yield.
Which you can automatically reinvest.
To acquire more shares, which then compound your position even faster, you are basically buying an automated cash flow machine.
That is the classical architecture of wealth building right there. It leverages the historical upward drift of global markets and corporate profitability.
But cost doesn't leave us safely in the 20th century with just traditional
No,
equities.
he really pushes forward.
He drags the analysis straight onto the bleeding edge of the digital frontier. And the mechanics of cryptocurrency and NFTs feel like an entirely alien financial system.
Because they kind of are. They are fundamentally re-architecting how trust operates.
How so?
If we connect this to the bigger picture earlier, we establish that fiat currency relies entirely on centralized trust,
A
right?
central bank and a sovereign government managing the ledger.
Exactly. Well, cryptographic assets like Bitcoin, Ethereum, or even Dogecoin attempt to strip the human element out of the equation entirely. They run on decentralized blockchain ledgers.
The blockchain being this immutable distributed database that cryptographically verifies every single transaction across thousands of independent nodes simultaneously.
Yes.
So you don't have to trust a bank executive not to manipulate the ledger. You just have to trust the mathematics of the algorithm.
Precisely. And non-fungible tokens, or NFTs, take that exact same distributed ledger technology and apply it to unique digital assets.
Okay, break that down for me.
Well, a Bitcoin is fungible. My token is identical in value and function to your token.
Right.
But an NFT is a cryptographically unique identifier tied to a specific piece of data, whether that's digital art, intellectual property, or an executable smart contract.
And the market capitalization achieved in this space is just staggering.
It's wild.
Cost highlights a single 8-bit digital avatar, a CryptoPunk NFT selling for $69 million.
Yeah, that happened.
To a traditional value investor looking at discounted cash flows, buying a digital JPEG for the GDP of a small island sounds like clinical insanity. Something like the Bored Ape Yacht Club, it starts to make a weird kind of sense.
How so?
The NFT isn't just a picture to look at. The smart contract acts as a cryptographic key. It grants the holder exclusive, verifiable access to gated digital ecosystems, private liquidity pools, and even exclusive physical real-world events.
And an unforgeable digital membership card.
And a highly liquid status symbol rolled into one.
True. But while the underlying technology, the smart contract architecture, is undeniably innovative, the textbook is ruthless about the risk profile here.
It's not for the faint of heart.
Not at all. The volatility is extreme. A digital asset can experience a 50 or 60% drawdown in a single trading session. Furthermore, there is severe liquidity risk. If the hype cycle cools, there is no market maker obligated to buy your token. You could be left holding a completely illiquid asset.
You're stuck with it.
Exactly. And from an ESG perspective, the computational energy required to secure proof-of-work blockchain networks is a massive environmental friction point.
It is the absolute Wild West. You are trading centralized stability for decentralized autonomy, and you are absorbing all the kinetic risk that comes with it.
Every ounce of it.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener? Like, how do we synthesize the slow compounding machinery of blue chip dividends with the hyper-volatile reality of decentralized assets?
It's a huge gap to bridge.
But the textbook points to an invisible bridge that is currently rewiring both systems, artificial intelligence.
Yes, and AI isn't some theoretical future state. It is actively executing the plumbing of modern personal finance right now.
We aren't talking about conversational chatbots asking how your day was.
No, we are talking about algorithmic neural networks conducting predictive investment analysis in real time, ingesting massive amounts of unstructured macro data to forecast trends.
They are running the high-frequency fraud detection models at your credit union, analyzing your spending telemetry, and isolating anomalous behavioral pattern in literally milliseconds.
They power the capital allocation engines in robo-advisors, too.
Dynamically rebalancing your ETF portfolios based on real-time volatility metrics. AI is basically automating the mundane, repetitive mechanics of wealth management.
But, and this is important, cost drops a very sobering reminder here. AI is an execution tool.
Right.
It can optimize your tax loss harvesting, and it can structure your budget categorizations, but it cannot define your personal risk tolerance.
It doesn't know your goals.
Exactly. Whether an algorithm is buying a treasury bond, leveraging a mortgage, or executing a smart contract on a decentralized crypto exchange, if you don't understand the underlying valuation metrics and the hidden fee structures, you aren't investing.
What are you doing then?
You are delegating your wealth to a black box. The algorithm can process the data, but you have to dictate the strategy.
You have to understand the mechanics, or you are just the product.
Well said.
Man, we have covered a massive amount of ground today. We unpacked the psychological trust and the mathematically guaranteed debasement of modern fiat currency.
We examined the architectural differences between chaotic debt defaults versus the highly structured legal receivership of Chapter 13 bankruptcy.
We explored the absolute necessity of transferring tail risk through insurance, the weaponized compounding of 400% payday loans, and how to counter that by accumulating positive collections via stable dividend-yielding equities.
And finally, we analyzed the structural paradigm shift of decentralized ledgers, the access mechanics of NFTs, and the predictive execution power of AI and asset management.
Which leaves us with a final concept for you to mull over on your own. We learned today that the traditional dollar in your pocket only works because humans inherently trust the sovereign institutions and central banks that issue it. Meanwhile, the new frontier of cryptographic assets was built specifically to be trustless, removing human frailty and putting absolute faith into decentralized mathematical code.
It is a complete inversion of how we secure and verify value.
Exactly. So as artificial intelligence models begin to autonomously manage more of our personal budgets, our fraud detection, and our microsecond investment trades, will the trust that gives money its utility permanently shift away from human institutions and entirely into the hands of artificial intelligence?
If an AI is securing the ledger and independently executing the trade, who or what are we actually trusting with our wealth?
It is arguably the defining financial question of the next decade.
Absolutely something to think about.
Something to think about. The next time your phone autonomously approves a transaction. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into money smarts. Keep questioning the mechanics, keep leveraging these insights, and go patch that microscopic hole in your bucket. We'll see you next time.